Okay, my name's Dan. I'm an alcoholic. And if you open your books to page 17, that's where we're going to start. And there's the solution. Then we're going to go bounce back in the middle of Bill Wilson's story. Bottom paragraph on page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. Page 18. Highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with us have found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss his situation without reserve. Strangely enough, wives, parents, and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor. But the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. That the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he's talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. And it's a lot of what we're going to be talking about when Abby comes to Bill Wilson in the middle of Bill's story. On page 20, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help their needs. At the end of the paragraph, it says, if you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking yourself, what do I have to do? And it is the purpose of the big book to answer these questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done before going into a detailed discussion. It may be well to summarize some points as we see them. How many times have people said to us, I can take it or leave it alone, why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Just lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. Oh, she's such a sweet girl. I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him, and yet there he is, all lit up again. And then there are the types of drinkers. There are the moderate drinkers that have little trouble giving up liquor entirely if they have a good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may need some medical attention. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. And on down it says, this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as behavior patterns may vary, but this description should identify him roughly. And that's referring to the paragraph before that, which is a long one about, here's the fella who has been puzzling you. And on page 24, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he's probably placed himself beyond human aid and, unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. So many want to stop but can't. There is a solution. And then it goes over and it talks about, in the next couple pages over, a certain American businessman. And that's Roy. also known as Roland Hazard. I was surprised when I first found out that his family called him Roy. I had never thought about that all the years. This guy came from a very influential family. His family basically started Rhode Island. Benjamin Hazard was a Rhode Island legislator, an attorney, and a member of the Sessions Hartford Convention. Jonathan Hazard was an American statesman, anti-federalist, delegate from Rhode Island in the Continental Congress. Nathaniel Hazard was a U.S. representative and Speaker of the House from Rhode Island. Oliver Hazard Perry was a Commodore of the United States Navy ship and hero of the Lake Erie, a famous battle cry, "Don't give up the ship," was made by the grandson of Mercy Howard. Matthew Perry, Commodore of the United States Navy, was the brother of Oliver Hazard, compelled the opening of Japan to the West in 1854. And Roland Gibson Hazard was an American industrialist, a politician, social reformer, a philosophical writer, and he corresponded with John Stuart Mill. He was also a friend of William Elling Channing, who was a founder of Unitarianism, which I guess is a religion. And Roland Hazard II, the grandson of Roland, was also a financial backer of the Solvay Process Company. Caroline Hazard was a sister of Frederick, granddaughter of Roland. She was a prolific author, artist, and she was the president of Wellesley College. But these people had all kinds of money. Roland Hazard was the guy in the family who always drank and got in trouble. Okay? And being in such an influential family, he was always winding up in the newspaper. He was always embarrassing his family. And Roland's story is really one that, you know, when you really dig into it, you find out that he was really a chronic relapser. He was a guy that just, even after he got sober, he had some difficulties. It's just not well documented. A lot of his history is not well documented. He didn't document anything. A lot of people have gone back through archives trying to figure out what happened in most of his life, even trying to narrow down the timeline that he would have spent at least a year with Carl Jung. And most of the information was gathered from letters. His sister and his mother did a lot of writing, and they were able to gather some of the information from that. But he started seeking psychiatric help. These were some of the most prolific thinkers in psychiatric minds of our time. All of these guys are you know, way out there. You got Sigmund Freud here, and you got Carl Jung on the right. We talked a little bit about how some of these guys would combat alcoholism with drugs like cocaine and heroin and marijuana and all kinds of stuff, LSD even. And of course, the only one of these guys that isn't a brilliant psychiatric mind is the poor guy in the back middle. He was just a writer. He was, you know, of minimal intelligence. He was just a brain surgeon. Okay. This is Carl Jung, and he treated Hazard. You find it in the big book on pages 26 and 27. Okay, and like it, people talk about him being there for a year. In order for him to be there for a year, as I dug back into it, it looks like it could have been as many as 7 years later before he wound up with the Oxford Group. The time he spent, where he could have spent at least a year with Carl Jung, would have been at least 7 years or around 7 years before he found the Oxford Group. And during that time, he tried a lot of different things. After he had spent a bunch of time with the doctor, he left there, went on a train headed towards Paris, and evidently he sat down to have a meal in Paris, and somebody asked him the wrong damn question. Would you like some wine with your dinner? And he woke up in a gutter, and then he went back to the doctor. He says, "Man, you need to help me some more, man. It didn't quite take." And he begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society, and he would have to be placed under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expect to keep living. Okay, Bill Wilson wrote letters later on to Carl Jung. He was trying to get more insight on the Roland situation and more insight into Carl Jung's perspective on alcoholism. Okay, and Carl Jung wrote back to Dr. Wilson, Bill Wilson. He said, "Your letter was very welcomed indeed. I had no news from Roland Hazard anymore, and often wondered what had been his fate. Our conversations, which has adequately been reported to you, had an aspect of which he did not know. The reason I could not tell him everything was that in those days I had to be exceedingly careful of what I said. I found out that I misunderstood him in every possible way. Thus, I was careful when I talked to Roland, but what I really thought was the result of many experiences with men of his kind. His craving for liquor was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God. What he's doing is he's going out on a limb here in a private conversation, doing what he couldn't do in public. Because back then it was heresy for doctors to talk about spiritual cure for psychiatric problems. Psychiatrics were problems of the mind, and the doctors were supposed to fix that with therapy and medication. They weren't supposed to lead somebody to a relationship with God to get well, because most of these psychiatrists were atheists in nature. Okay, one of the places that he did seek therapy beyond when he was with Carl Jung was in the Emmanuel movement. This guy, Courtney Baylor, was one of the heads of that. Roland was involved with them for a while trying to get sober and of course relapsed again. Most likely this was in the period of time after he spent a year with Carl Jung and before he wound up with the Oxford Group. One of the guys also involved in the Emmanuel movement was Richard Peabody, and he wrote a book we've already talked a little bit about earlier, The Common Sense of Drinking, came out in 1931. One of the things that he said in his book that wound up in the big book was half measures are to no avail. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, that came from his book. This guy didn't make it, he relapsed and died, okay? Sober for quite a while, but he didn't make it. Now, the Oxford Group was involved in a lot of different things. They did a lot of advertising. The big thing back then was going into a theater and watching a movie or a play, mostly like a play. And during the plays, they would have breaks. And during the breaks, they would have commercials. These commercials were skits. And the Oxford Group would actually do skits at these theaters as advertisement for the Oxford Group to bring people into their spiritual movement. These are illustrations from some of their skits. And this is Vic Kitchen, who wrote I Was a Pagan. We talked about that a little bit before. There he is as a younger man, and there he is in a couple of the skits. So he was very involved in the Oxford Group. And he wrote this book, I Was a Pagan, which was more like someone's view of what was going on there. He said, they had a power I did not have. This was in his book. They said, however, that I could have it just as they did if I would pay the same price, comply with the same conditions, and go through the same series of exceedingly simple steps. Right here is where the first example of steps being used in an Oxford Group setting by someone writing about the Oxford Group, not in the Oxford Group itself. They didn't call them steps, but Vic Kitchen did in his book. His third step prayer version was, I surrender thee my entire life, O God. I've made a mess of it, trying to run it myself. You take it, the whole thing, and run it for me according to your will and your plan. And then also in his book, which kind of wound up in the big book, I was able to supplant the all-important why of life with the still more important how of living. There's the how and the why of it that Bill talks about in the big book. I was able to begin really solving my own problems, and for the first time in my experience, was given the power to begin to help others. Okay, now perhaps this book, some of the other books about the Oxford Group, were responsible for Roland Hazard winding up in the Oxford Group. As the story goes, he was on a train and was reading some of this material and other stuff, and on that train had his spiritual experience, and then sought out the Oxford Group to get involved with what he had heard that they were doing. Hey, now there was a big connection with all these people in the formation of AA that centered around people that either lived in or spent time in Vermont. Bill Wilson, of course, grew up in Vermont. Lois would go to Vermont to their vacation home, Lois Wilson. Abby Thatcher was sent there to a home that they had course, Ebbe was from Albany, New York, where his family was very influential and mayor and all kinds of stuff. Roland Hazard also vacationed in Vermont. Dr. Bob was born there. And then Seaver Graves and Shep Cornell were also involved in influential families. They're two of the guys that were with Roland when he rescued Ebbe Thatcher when he went to court. Okay, so here we're going to talk about Ebbe Thatcher. Ebbe, another guy in his family, gets in trouble, gets in the news. His family's a big deal in New York and Albany. And they said, look, we just got to send you off. So they sent him to Vermont, to their summer cottage, so he could just kind of get away and stop making so much ruckus, okay? And he started getting in trouble there too, of course. This was in 1934, okay, and he winds up going to court. Two of the things that got him into the most trouble, he's out driving intoxicated, drives his car directly into a lady's kitchen, gets out of the car, tips his hat, and said, ma'am, sir, could I trouble you for a cup of coffee? Okay? Don't go too well. An example of what's going on in this neighborhood, across the street from him are direct descendants of Abraham Lincoln, some guy named Abraham Lincoln. His grandson lived across the street. I mean, this is a high-priced neighborhood, okay? So Ebbe's back to his house, been to the judge. The judge told him, don't drink no more, don't come back in here, or I'm going to send you off to the mental institution for 6 months or a year. I'm just going to get rid of you. So he gets back to his house. He realizes he's not going to be able to drink again, and he decides he's going to paint the house. Okay, so he gets out and starts painting the house, and he kind of gets thirsty, and then he remembers that there's a few cases of ale down in the cellar. He says, you know, he's got this alcoholic logic going, okay? He thinks to himself, he says, with this ale down here, if I'm not going to be drinking, then I need to get rid of this ale. And as purely as an alcoholic mind would think, he figures the best way to get rid of the ale is to freaking drink it, okay? So he gets loaded, and he's painting the house, and he got around the one part of the house, and he needed to go higher, but he's too drunk to go up a ladder, so he finally had to stop, and he's sitting back in a lawn chair admiring his work, and these pigeons are coming around, and these pigeons are messing up his work. They're dumping on his wall and stuff like this. So he goes in and gets the shotgun and starts blasting at the freaking pigeons. Okay? And again, in this neighborhood, it doesn't go too well. Cops come out. He winds up in jail again. Winds up in front of the judge. Now, you would think in the big book, I always had the impression that these guys just showed up in court because they knew him. Well, it was more than that. They'd already been working on Ebbe. Ebbe had already been spending some time with him. He would come over to the mansions where they'd be at the swimming pool. These are people with loads of money. They're not having to go off of work every day. Okay, I mean, some of them were involved in some stuff, you know, for making money and all that. But you know, these guys were playing. This was a resort town, and Ebbe would spend some time with these people. And when he was with them, I remember my father telling me about, you know, his life. You know, and he was my dad was bad to drink, but he talked to him about how he lived two different lives. He had people in places he would go and he would drink with, and then he had the people from the church that he would run around with and spend time with. And Ebbe was doing a little bit of the same thing, because every time he would get to drinking, he would get in trouble. So he would spend these periods of not drinking and associate with these guys, and they had already been working with him, trying to get him involved in the Oxford group and trying to get him to stop drinking. So this wasn't just a spur-of-the-moment thing. They had already been working on him. This idea was already supplanted in his head. And they showed up, and of course, Seaver Graves here, the one second on the bottom, from the left, his father was the actual judge. Now you can imagine Seaver was probably, I can't remember if it was Seaver or Shep Cornell, one of the two in the middle was alcoholic and the other one wasn't. But they were both to get in trouble. I mean, the judge's mindset was not to help him because of his son having any influence. So evidently his son was, you know, kind of a little bit of a crackerjack too. But Roland Hazard was influential enough, and he had been sober a little while, and the judge had known all of these guys to have problems. They're all there. They're there sober. They said, we think we can help Ebbe stay sober. We've got a plan to try and help him. And of course, the deal that they made to start with was, okay, it's Friday. I'm going to release him to you for the weekend. bring him back in here Monday morning, still sober, and I'll consider what I'm going to do. So Ebby had to stay sober for the weekend. He winds up back at his house by himself, and he remembers there's four more bottles of ale in the freaking, okay, and he gets to working on this out and that. But he's really seriously considering this not drinking thing this time, okay? And you don't hear anything about it, but Ebby, he's considering what he's going to do with those four bottles of ale, and he actually took those four bottles of ale and carried them down the street and a couple doors down and across the street and gave them away to somebody else. And that's described later as a spiritual experience and a turning point for Ebby, where he made that decision to give away that booze. And that's when he really kind of made up his mind to give sobriety a try. Okay, and Judge Graves released, I just told you about all that. Ebby remembered his thought, well, I just couldn't do it. That wouldn't be playing the game square, so he took the four bottles three doors down and gave them to a neighbor. Okay, and now we're going to get back to Bill Wilson. And we talked about in week one, it got him good and drunk, all the different ways that he tried to stop drinking, his geographical to Canada, the relapse on Jersey Lightning, realizing that he meant business, he couldn't even have one drink, his renewed resolve, his cocksuredness, his laughing at Jen Mills, and then his belladonna treatment, hydrotherapy, exercise, and realization that the will is weak in regards to alcohol. And then his second treatment, when he learned about the abnormal physical reaction and the self-knowledge, where he was sober on self-knowledge, and then that he realized his health was failing and he was hopeless, cornered at last. He was concerned about his wife and desired to make it right. And he said, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And in trembling, he stepped from the hospital a broken man, and fear sobered him for a bit. And then again, the first drink and the Armistice Day relapse, and he was off again. Okay. And now at this point, his brother-in-law starts getting involved and helping him get into the hospital for treatment. He's treated at Towns Hospital, which was founded in 1917. It was a drying out facility. Modern Hospital magazine said, there's no such thing as curing a case of, he told them, there's no such thing as curing a case of alcoholism. There is nothing on earth you can do to prevent any human being from taking it up again if he wants to. And actually, he made his mark and got famous and it was really a thriving. His business started thriving. What he did was he had the mob was sending mobsters to his facility to dry them out. Okay, and I can imagine it's a little bit easier to sober somebody up that they know if they relapse again, they're going to wind up in some cement slippers, you know. But anyway, that's how he got famous. The mobsters would go there and get sober their people. And then they regular people started using them too. Dr. Silkworth treated Bill Wilson in 1933 and 1934. And from Dr. Silkworth, Bill Wilson learned about the nature of alcoholism. He learned about alcoholism as being an illness. He learned about the mental aspect. And he also learned about the physical component and the abnormal physical reaction. His description of the disease to Bill was an obsession of the mind that condemns one to drink, an allergy of the body that condemns one to die. Okay, and on page 9, bottom of page 8 actually, my musing was interrupted by the telephone. Cheery voice of an old friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. It was years since I remember having seen him in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcohol and insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course I would have him for dinner, and then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was a time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. Okay, these guys had run around together, okay? Bill Wilson knew Ebby well. He knew how bad of a drunk that Ebby was. He had often watched Ebby drink, and he said, if I ever get as bad as Ebby, I'll quit. okay? This story about chartering an airplane sounds really fancy, don't it? No, it wasn't fancy at all. These guys were in a bar getting drunk. Another guy that was in the bar getting drunk happened to be a pilot. They start running their mouth to each other. Let's get a plane. They're building this airport in Manchester, and let's be the first ones in history to land there. So they take this drunk pilot to another airport, probably stole a plane, okay? Mm-hmm. It probably was a plane they didn't even have permission to use, okay? And they paid the pilot with a bottle of booze, which they drank on the way to land in Manchester. So did anybody, I'm sure a lot of you guys watch MASH, okay? Do you remember 5 o'clock Charlie on MASH? They always thought the plane was, they thought it was going to crash. It was come over and throw these leaflets out. But the plane was always, you know, they thought it was going to crash every time. This were these guys. They clipped the trees when they come over into the to land in Manchester. They almost crashed the plane coming in. They roll up to the turnpike. They're practicing for the opening ceremony. The mayor's there, the band's there, there's people there practicing for the next day, and they had sent a telegram. They land this freaking plane, and these three freaking drunks fall out on the ground, okay? And so they spent several days after that writing letters of apology to the town, to the mayor, to, you know, and just their families. You know, it was not a good time. It was a very embarrassing situation for them, okay? But he describes this is a big deal. What Bill Wilson sees when Ebbie approaches him that day is a really big deal. It's a turning point for Bill Wilson, and it pushes this point about, you know, one alcoholic being able to connect with, and the identification process, because this is where it really happens for Bill, and he really gets his attention, because he knows Ebbie is a hopeless drunk, and it's what he's seeing with his eyes doesn't match the person that he knows. The door opened and there he stood. This is from his original story. Bill Wilson's original story was three times longer than what wound up in the book. The door opened and there he stood, very erect and glowing. His deep voice boomed out, cheery, the cast of his features, his eyes, the freshness of his complexion. This was my friend of school days. He's seeing a guy that he knew young when he was competent, and he's seeing him again in that condition after he's been a drunk. There was a subtle something or other instantly apparent even to my befuddled perception. Yes, there was certainly something more. He was inexplicably different. What had happened to him? Okay, so he's made this connection. He's trying to find, well, Ebbie, what did you do? Okay, now this story is not as simple as it seems in the book. There was more to Ebbie coming to Bill Wilson. It wasn't like he went there one time, he talked to him, and then everything done. No, there was more than one visit. He wound up, you know, the first time he showed up, that Bill looked at him and slammed the door on his ass, okay? I mean, he had to go back through Lois and arrange a particular time to come where he was invited, and Bill showed up. But eventually, you know, they spent some time conversing enough that Bill knew he had a solution. My friend suggested what seemed a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And he eased him up a little bit. So I still gagged baggily of the notion of a power greater than myself. But finally, just for the moment, the vestiges of my proud obstinacy was crushed. He said, this statement about my own conception hit me hard. It melted away the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I have lived for many shivering years. And I stood there in the sunlight at last. He got his attention, okay? He recognized, go ahead.
Did Ebbie look like that when he came to see Bill?
I don't know. He looks a little younger. Younger at that.
He was young.
Well, no, he wasn't that young when he came to Bill. I forget exactly how old he was, but he was probably 40s and a lot more disheveled, and that's probably a picture from his college, early college, right there. So, the man was transformed. There was no denying that he had been reborn. He was radiant of something which soothed my troubled spirit as though the fresh, clean wind of a mountaintop blew through me. I saw and felt a great surge of joy when I realized the great presence. Okay, he's starting to describe his spiritual experience, but that happened after some other things. Okay, he had met with Ebbie, and of course, Bill, with his keen intellectual mind, he's figuring, all I need to do is I need to go over here to this Oxford group, and I need to learn what they're doing, and then I could fix myself. So he decided he was going to go down there to the Calvary Mission, and he was going to go down there and he was going to investigate. But the problem was, he headed down there and decided to have a few drinks on the way. Okay. And he didn't want to go by himself, so he started looking around in the bars for somebody to take with him. And he wound up meeting a guy called Alex. Alex was a Finnish guy. Alex the Finn. Always got to have a good Finnish guy in a story, right? Okay, so Alex the Finn and Bill Wilson wind up going to the Asha group, and they're having a service. Now, these guys show up. They're already intoxicated. They weren't even really going to let him in. This is where Ebby sponsored Bill. This is where the sponsorship idea. A lot of times you needed to be sponsored to come in. Somebody would bring you into the Oxford group. So Ebby saw that they were there, and he went in, and he sponsored him in, and he said, I'll take care of him, and I'll bring him in. But when they went in, they sat down at this service, Ebby made a fatal mistake, okay? If you've got a drunk guy in a church service, you don't let him sit on the outside of the pew. You keep him on the inside so you can keep him cornered. But Bill Wilson's this tall, lanky dude, and so he wound up being sitting on the edge, and he decided he was going to get up and go testify. And that's what he did. He got up there drunk and told his story in front of that group of people, and he continued on in the service. He made one of these, guys always watch like Billy Graham, and they start having the altar call, and Bill Wilson went to the altar and gave his life to God, and he woke up in a horrendous state the next morning, remembering this kind of half blackout that he had and all the things. He says, I was singing old camp songs and dancing for Jesus. Okay? He was just horrified with the experience that he had had when he remembered what all he had done. He felt like he embarrassed himself. He'd never be able to show his face in public again. But he took what little bit of an experience he had had, but he recognized that there was a solution there for him if he was willing to have it. And headed off to treatment again, because once he started drinking, he would have detox symptoms and have to go to the hospital to keep from having seizures and perhaps dying. As he's making these recognitions of the possibility that the help lies in a spiritual experience and with God, he recalls once again his experience that he had in Winchester Cathedral. And we talked about that in week one. He said, I stood in Winchester Cathedral the day before crossing over with my head bowed. Something had touched me, and it was like I had never felt something like I had never felt before. I had been wondering in a rare moment of sober reflection once since there could be to all the killing and carnage of which I was soon to become an enthusiastic part. Where could the deity be? Could there be such a thing? Where now was the God of the preachers? The thought of which used to make me so uncomfortable when they talked about him. A feeling of despair settled down on me. Where was he? Why did he not come? And suddenly, in that moment of darkness, he was there. I felt an all-enveloping, comforting, powerful presence. Tears stood in my eyes, and I looked all about. I saw the faces of the others nearby. They, too, had glimpsed the great reality. Much moved, I walked outside the cathedral yard. Okay, so he had this remarkable spiritual experience back right when he had first started drinking, and he had turned away from it and got back into himself and abandoned it all these years, but now he's back to recognizing that a spiritual experience could solve his problems, and he's in the hospital once again. And of course, in the hospital, he has this white light experience. Now, it's important to understand a lot of things, and I try not to focus on this too much, but Bill Wilson embellished a lot of stuff. He borrowed a lot of stuff from other people. He was a synthetic thinker. He would use whatever was at hand to make the point that he needed to make. Okay, and also when he's in the hospital, he's taking drugs that are hallucinogenic in nature. Okay, there's some stuff I'm not going to talk about in the news recently about that. Drugs and helping people have spiritual experiences and deal with things like PTSD. But he described later his white light experiences. All at once I found myself crying out, if there is a God, let him show himself. I'm ready to do anything. And said, suddenly the room lit up with a great white light. I was caught up in an ecstasy which there are no words to describe. It seemed to me in my mind's eye that I was on a mountain and that the wind, not of air, but of spirit, was blowing. and then it burst upon me, and I was a free man. This is an article he wrote in the Grapevine. What happened next was electric. Suddenly my room was ablaze with an indescribably white light. I was seized with an ecstasy beyond description. Every joy I had known was pale by comparison. The light, the ecstasy, I was conscious of nothing else for a time. Then, seen in the mind's eye, there was a mountain. I stood upon its summit where a great wind blew, a wind not of air but of spirit, and a great clean strength that blew right through me. And this is from Pass It On. Then came the blazing thought, you're a free man. I know not at all how long I remained in this state, but finally the light and the ecstasy subsided. I again saw the wall of my room. As I became more quiet, a great peace stole over me. And this was accomplished by a sensation difficult to describe. I became acutely conscious of a presence which seemed like a veritable sea of living spirit. I lay on the shores of a new world. Also from Pass It On. Turkey. Okay, and this is where Ebby brought him this book. Now, if anybody's ever tried to read this book, okay, this is a heady, thick freaking book. It is a tough read. I gave it a shot. I could read quite a bit of it, but we know for certain that he read one particular story in this book, because Ebby knew that the guy that was leading the Calvary mission, okay, was a friend of Ebby's, and Ebby's father was written about in this book, and he had an experience similar to Bill Wilson's experience. So this book was brought to him, and this book described this book was different than other books that were written about theologies, because these theological books were always written with a focus. They were written about one specific doctrine. Okay, this one would explore all different types of experience with all different kinds of people. It examined transformational experiences of numerous famous people and how these experiences had influenced their lives, and it did not support any one theology. Okay, but this is the guy over here on the left, was Harry Hadley's, Samuel Hopkins was Harry Hadley's father. And dear reader, with mortal tongue can I describe that moment. He's describing his spiritual experience. Although up to that time my soul had been filled with indescribable gloom, both of these guys were hopeless alcoholics. I felt the glorious brightness of the noonday sunshine in my heart. I felt that I was a free man. From that moment until now, I've never wanted a drink of whiskey and have never seen enough money to make me want to take one. Like I said, he went on to work most of the rest of his life in a mission. And then his son, Harry Hadley, wound up leading the Calvary mission. After his father died, he had a similar turning around in his life and got sober after his father died, and then followed in his footsteps and worked the Calvary mission. Okay, the conversion of Samuel Hadley, who worked for the Jerry McCauley and his mission in New York. On the night of Sunday, April 23rd, 1882, a man came into the mission. Sam came into the mission, weak from the after effects of a severe attack of, he was detoxing. He could not push through the crowd. A tramp saw how anxious he was and asked, "Do you want to go in?" And he said, "Yes." He said, he hung up his coat. The tramp forced his way all the way through the crowd and dragged the man up toward the front. He listened to the testimonies, he prayed, and was born anew. The man was Samuel Hopkins. Almost every moment of his adult life before that night had been compounded of self-gratification, pleasure, fraud, and deceit. Almost every moment after, until his death in 1906, was compounded of self-sacrifice, sympathy, and love. Okay, this is a little bit about Ebby. His original surrender was November 1st, 1934, and he was only dry 2 months when he came to Bill Wilson. He lived another 31 years after that, and he was sober for about half of it. Okay, his original sobriety was 2 years and 7 months, and his longest sobriety was later on in life. His sponsor was Searcy in Dallas, and he was sober at that point for nearly 7 years. He died in March of 1966 at 70 years of age, and at that point had been sober 2.5 years. So he went on as a chronic relapser and had several different periods of sobriety. And it was also, you know, he showed up and spoke at a few places too. There's some stuff you can listen to of him. But Bill Wilson, after his experience, he had been going around trying to witness to people and use what he had learned to help other drunks. But he was just trying to drag people off of bar stools, carry them down to the Calvary Mission. And in 6 months, he didn't have any success at all. He worked with a lot of people, but he didn't have any success connecting and getting anybody else sober. He tells his wife, Lois, says, Lois, I'm a failure. This is not working. It's not working at all. Lois is the one that told him and pointed out to him, Bill, this is working great because you're still sober. This idea of trying to help other alcoholics is working just as it's supposed to. It's helping you stay sober. She was the one that pointed that out to him. Silkworth met with him and he told Bill, he says, Bill, you got to stop preaching to these guys. You got to tell them what I told you. Emphasize the abnormal physical reaction, you know, emphasize the mental obsession, get connected with them first, and then you can mention the spiritual stuff later. So Bill gets an opportunity in a business deal. It's kind of like a hostile takeover where he's got this group to go in, buy stock and take over this company, and they're having a stockholders meeting and they're supposed to have enough votes that they can take over the company. And Bill Wilson is heading up the group and they go to the Mayflower Hotel to stay while they're pulling off this deal. Okay, the deal fell apart. And go back to Akron. Now, the Mayflower's in Akron. We go back to how the Oxford Group wound up getting to Akron. Jim Newton had been a friend of Bud Firestone. Bud Firestone had his conversion experience. His father was so impressed and overwhelmed that he had a bunch of people in from the Oxford Group. As a result of the Oxford Group coming to the Mayflower Hotel and having this big convention, the Oxford Group had gotten active in Akron. Okay, of the people, the 60-man team that came, it was a 10-day revival or whatever you want to call it, where they had this convention for 10 days. And man, you had to spend a lot of money in 10 days having a big convention and paying for everything. But a lot of people came to that. These two people showed up. This is T. Henry and Clarice Williams. They would go on to have Oxford Group meetings in their house. T. Henry was actually, oddly enough, one of the primary people in charge of the company that Bill Wilson went there to take over. Okay, he failed to take over the company. T. Henry was instrumental in being the guy that defeated Bill Wilson in his business venture. Interesting. So, and he wound up, you know, Bill Wilson wound up going to meetings at his house. Also attending at the Mayflower Hotel and getting involved with the Oxford Group is this lady, Henrietta Cyberling. She had a sponsee that she took with her to the Mayflower. Her name was Ann Smith. And Ann Smith had a husband named Dr. Bob, who was a drunk. Okay, so Bill Wilson's at this Mayflower Hotel. His deal falls apart. He's about to drink, and he was even considering going into the bar. I'll just have a ginger ale and, you know, talk to some like-minded people. He realizes he needs to find a drunk to talk to. So he goes to the phone booth, and he starts looking at the phone booth, and he picked out a name to call. And he called Reverend Tunks, okay, Walter Tunks. He happened to be involved in the Oxford Group going back to the Mayflower meeting, so he knew other people that were involved with the Oxford Group. My understanding is that he gave him a list of people to call. Reverend Tunks provided Bill with numbers of 10 Oxford Group members, to which Bill risked his then precious nickels to no avail. Save one contact. He got a response from one guy, Norman Shepherd, who knew about Henrietta Cyberling's efforts to help a doctor get off the hooch. Okay, so Bill's making these phone calls, and it's Mother's Day weekend. So a lot of the calls, he probably didn't get an answer. People weren't home. And I don't think they had a fancy answering machine that picked it up and took a message either. This was a long time ago. Okay. Norman Shepherd told you about Henrietta Seiberling, and her name made Bill wax with diffidence because he realized that she was a member of the prestigious Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company and such a millionaire socialite. He was embarrassed to call. He had been involved with dealings, business dealings with Goodyear, and he kind of sort of knew who the Seiberlings were. He was embarrassed to call. He didn't realize that she wasn't really involved in the company. She had been married to the son of the Goodyear founder. She had been married to, and she was just a daughter-in-law, was still living on the property, but she was in the process or already divorced, okay? But he knew that she'd take a dim view of helping some unknown guy from New York find another drunk. He left a telephone call, he was dejected, and he returned to his room, but he got so desperate, he finally went down and called her. Okay, so Henrietta had been sponsoring, and oddly enough, as I read about this, Henrietta had actually reached out to Ann and got her involved with the Oxford Group and stuff because someone had come to her and told her about Dr. Bob needing help. So she had actually instigated being Ann's sponsor and getting her involved and getting them to come to meetings. Okay, and of course, Dr. Bob was coming to the meetings, but he was a drunk. Okay. Let's go back and talk a little bit about Dr. Bob. Okay, born in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. His father was Walter Perrin Smith. His father had his office, I believe he was a judge, attorney, but his office was in the YMCA building. We talked about all the different connections to the YMCA. Okay, his mother was Susan Holbrook. Bob's boyhood home is now a drug and alcohol treatment center. Okay. He attended church when he was young 4 times a week. He was a member of the North Congregational Church and the New England Congregationalism Revivals and Evangelists. And the YMCA had strong influence in St. Johnsbury. He attended St. Johnsbury Academy there. He managed the Glee Club and also sang. Most people don't know Dr. Bob was a good singer. Literary society he was a member of. He participated in debates. He wasn't that quiet of a guy. He was very well spoken. He was the orator at the graduation ceremony. He participated in the Christian Endeavor Society and the YMCA. Christian Endeavor was founded by the Fairbanks. The Fairbanks and Dr. Bob's father were close friends. And again, the judge had offices in the YMCA. And the Christian Endeavor Society and the YMCA, look at the things that Dr. Bob was taught when he was younger that he brought into his Oxford Group participation and eventually AA and helping drunks. He talked about quiet hours, prayer meetings, talked about love and service, obedience to God's will, talked about inviting a decision, talked about doing our Father's business, fellowshipping with like-minded believers, and a lot of it was non-denominational, non-sectarian, and it mostly talked about trusting God, growth through power and reading in order to serve, and temperance was encouraged by the endeavors. St. Johnsbury, he was required to attend daily chapel and required church attendance. They required Bible study, and they used Christian textbooks. In response to this heavy doctrine and training that Dr. Bob received when he was younger, he swore when he grew up he'd never go to church. I can relate 100% to this. I felt the same way that after I was taken to church every time the doors were open, and a lot of times when they were, when I grow up, I am not going to put myself through this anymore. Had his first drink at the age of 9. At Dartmouth College, he became the champion beer drinker. That's a boy, Bob. After graduating from Dartmouth, Bob went on to the University of Michigan and as a med student, where he had his first experience with hangover and morning shakes, and he had previously boosted of never having a hangover, but then he started having trouble with alcohol when he got to Michigan. University. Okay, he quit University of Michigan to dry out after repeated binges. When he got ready to go back, the faculty of the university said they didn't want him back. So he transferred to Rush University, and the binges continued. He wound up getting put on probation, and he actually managed to stay dry for 6 months so he could graduate and get his medical degree. He interned at the city hospital in Akron, okay, and he stayed so busy there that he remained bone dry for 2 years. But then he developed stomach troubles, and in order to medicate himself, started drinking again. And he was committed to various, he was committed to treatment of some kind at least a dozen times. He eventually landed, he was so terrified and so shook up with the way that his life was working out that he wound up back at his parents' house, and he stayed there for 2 months in his own childhood bed, crying himself to sleep every night. Interesting, he met Anne at a dance when she was 17 years old, high school, okay? They courted, dated for 17 years before they got married, okay? She's considered the mother of AA, and Dr. Bob, of course, was eventually considered the prince of all 12-steppers. Most people know how much Dr. Bob loved his cars. His son described him as an excellent bridge player. He also had tremendous physical drive and a great physical stamina, again, according to his son, Smitty. Dr. Bob's wife attended Oxford Group meetings from 1933, 2 years before her husband recovered from alcoholism in 2 years before her husband's recovery, and until 1939, during which she kept a workbook or spiritual journal. Some of the things that wound up in the big book that came from Ann Smith were, "O Lord, manage me, for I cannot manage myself," and the pertinent ideas came from her journals. "We can't give it away if we haven't got it," that came from her journals. She said, "Surrender is not an attitude attained, it's an attitude maintained," and I've got copies of some of the highlights from her journal up here to hand out at the end. Okay, and this is a copy of it. You know, we talked about all the different parts of the Oxford Group and the separate simple little parts of it, but it was really, according to her journals anyway, a lot more complicated than that. There's 27 different points on this document. Okay, so Bill Wilson is at the Mayflower. He's needing to talk to a drunk. He calls Henrietta Seiberling on the phone. Now, Henrietta had been having these meetings, okay, and she had a couple of weeks before Bill Wilson called her, she has been chairing the meetings at the Oxford Group, and she told everybody ahead of time to come prepared to share something costly about yourself. And they got to the meeting, and as they went around, people were telling stuff that had, you know, it was kind of like a little mini fifth step meeting where you're telling some of the worst things that's going on with you. And so they came to Dr. Bob, and he finally participated in that and told him, says, "Look, this will probably get me thrown out of my practice." He says, "But the truth of the matter is I'm a closet drunk, okay? And, you know, I'd really like help." And they said, "Well, would you like us to pray with you about that?" And so they did. And so they started praying for what Henrietta called manna from heaven. They were believing that God was going to send somebody to help Dr. Bob. And so when Bill Wilson called Henrietta Seiberling on the phone and he says, "I'm a rum hound from New York and I'm looking for a drunk that I can help," why, Henrietta says, "Well, of course you are. I've been expecting your call." Okay? You probably could have knocked Bill Wilson over with a feather. She said, "Come right over. I've got just the guy." Okay, so Bill Wilson heads over to the mansion, and she calls Ann Smith, says, "You need to get Dr. Bob over here right away. He's arrived. The one who was foretold to us has arrived." And Ann Smith told her, says, "Well," she says, "tomorrow's Mother's Day, and Bob knows how much I like potted plants, and he brought me a potted plant for Mother's Day. And right now, he's laid out underneath the piano, more potted than the plant. Okay? So they weren't able to come that day, but they came the next day. And his son Smitty would drive him over. And of course, he told his son Smitty, he says, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to meet with this cat. He says, but 15 minutes, come and get me out. We got to go. I'm not staying too long, but I will listen to him for 15 minutes. And so he shows up, he walks in the room with Bill Wilson. And Bill Wilson takes one look at him and says, boy, you sure look like you could use a drink, buddy. And Dr. Bob told him, he says, I have no idea what you think you can do to help me. And Bill Wilson tells him, says, you misunderstand. He says, I'm not here to help you. I'm here because talking to you is going to help me not to drink. And he started talking to him, and he approached him more like Silkworth had told him. He started telling Dr. Bob about the mental obsession, about the abnormal physical reaction. And even being a doctor, this was information that Bill Wilson didn't have and didn't fully understand. Their 15 minutes together became 5 hours. And after that, Dr. Bob didn't drink anymore. He went to the medical conference. Had a relapse and came back. As soon as he got back from there, he did the one thing that he had said, you know, that he would never do, and that was get out and make amends. And then they started looking for AA number 3 and found Bill Dotson, who's the man on the bed, carried the message to him. He was an attorney, and he stayed sober. And Dr. Bob took an estimated 5,000 people through the steps in his 15 years of sober life before he passed away. Teamed up with Six Sisters of Nation to start getting people into hospitals. And those were the guys that founded Alcoholics Anonymous. And our time a lot faster than I would have liked, but we reached the end. Lord's Prayer.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
I want one of them.